Mallory and Fraser ate gritty sandwiches of turkey and bacon from a glass-sided hot cart. They were once again unable to hire a cabriolet. None were visible in the street. The underground stations were all closed, with angry sand-hog pickets shouting foul abuse at passers-by. The day's second appointment in Jermyn Street was a severe disappointment to Mallory. He had come to the museum to confer about his speech, but Mr. Keats, the Royal Society conotropist, had sent a telegram declaring himself very ill, and Huxley had been dragooned into some committee of savant lordships meeting to consider the emergency. Mallory could not even manage to cancel his speech, as Disraeli had suggested, for Mr. Trenham Reeks declared himself unable to make such a decision without Huxley's authority, and Huxley himself had left no forwarding address or telegram number. To add salt to the wound, the Museum of Practical Geology was almost deserted. The cheery crowds of schoolchildren and natural history enthusiasts depleted to a few poor, sullen wretches clearly come in for the sake of cleaner air and some escape from the heat. They slouched and loitered under the towering skeleton of the Leviathan as if they longed to crack its mighty bones and suck the marrow. There was nothing for it but to tramp back to the Palace of Paleontology and prepare for the night's dinner with the Young Men's Agnostic Association. The YMAA were a savantry student group. Mallory, as a lion of the evening, would be expected to make a few after-dinner remarks. He'd been quite looking forward to the event, as the YMAA were a jolly lot, not at all as pompous as their respectable name might suggest, and the all-male company would allow him to make a few unbuttoned jests suitable for young bachelors. Mallory had heard several such from Dizzy Disraeli that he thought very good indeed, but now he wondered how many of his erstwhile hosts were left in London, or how the young men might manage to gather together if they were still so inclined, and worst yet, what the dining might be like in the upstairs room of the Blackfriar Pub, which was near Blackfriars Bridge and just upwind of the Thames. The streets were visibly emptying. Shop after shop bore closed signs. Mallory had hoped to find a barber to trim his hair and beard, but he'd had no such luck. London's citizenry had fled, or gone to earth behind tight-closed windows. Smoke had settled to ground level and mixed with a fetid fog, a yellow pea-soup of it everywhere, and it was difficult to see the length of a half-block. The rare pedestrians emerged from obscurity like well-dressed ghosts. Fraser led the way, uncomplaining and unerring, and Mallory supposed that the veteran copper could have led them through the London streets blindfolded with near as much ease. They wore their kerchiefs over their faces now. It seemed a sensible precaution, though it rather bothered Mallory that Fraser now seemed gagged as well as reticent. "The kinotropes are the sticking point," Mallory opined, as they tramped up the Brompton Road, the spires of its scientific palaces obscured by fetor. "It wasn't like this before I left England. 2 years ago the damn things were nowhere near so common. Now I'm not allowed to give a public speech without one." He coughed. "It gave me a turn to see that long panel back in Fleet Street, mounted in front of the Evening Telegraph, clacking away like 60 over the heads of the crowd. Trains closed as sand hogs strike," the thing said. "Parliament decries State of Thames." "What's wrong with that?" Fraser asked. "It doesn't say anything," Mallory said. "Who in Parliament? What State of the Thames specifically? What did Parliament say about it? Wise things or foolish things?" Fraser grunted. "There is a wicked pretense that one has been informed, but no such thing has truly occurred. A mere slogan, an empty litany. No arguments are heard, no evidence is weighed. It isn't news at all, only a source of amusement for idlers." "Some might say it's better for idlers to know a bit than nothing at all." "Some might be damned fools then, Fraser. This keener sloganry is like printing banknotes with no gold to back them, or writing cheques on an empty account. If that is to be the level of rational discourse for the common folk, then I must say 3 cheers for the authority of the House of Lords." A fire gurney chugged slowly past them, with weary firemen on its running boards, their clothing and faces blackened at their work, or perhaps by the London air itself, or perhaps by the streaming, stinking soot of the gurney's own smokestacks. To Mallory, it seemed a strangely ironic thing that a fire gurney should propel itself through the agency of a heap of blazing coal. But perhaps there was sense in it after all, for in weather like this, a team of horses would be hard put to gallop a block. Mallory was anxious to soothe his raw throat with a hucklebuff, but it seemed smokier inside the Palace of Paleontology than out. There was a harsh stench, like burnt linen. Perhaps Kelly's imperial gallons of manganate of soda had eaten through the pipes. In any case, this stink seemed to have finally defeated the palace guests, for there was scarcely a soul in the lobby and not a murmur from the dining room. Mallory was looking for service in the saloon, amid the lacquered screens and red silk upholstery, when Kelly himself appeared, his face taut and resolute.
"Dr. Mallory?"
"Yes, Kelly?"
"I've bad news for you, sir. An unhappy event here. A fire, sir."
Mallory glanced at Fraser.
"Yes, sir,"
the concierge said.
"So, when you left today, did you perhaps leave clothing near the gas jet? Or a cigar still smouldering?"
"You don't mean to say the fire was in my room?"
"I fear so, sir."
"A serious fire?"
"The guests thought it so, sir. So did the firemen."
Kelly said nothing of the feelings of the palace staff, but his face made his sentiments clear.
"I always turn out the gas," Mallory blurted. "I don't recall exactly, but I always turn out the gas." "Your door was locked, sir. Firemen had to break it in."
"We'll want a look," Fraser suggested mildly. The door of Mallory's room had been axed in, and the warped floor was awash with sand and water. Mallory's heaps of magazines and paper correspondence had blazed up very fiercely, thoroughly consuming his desk and a great blackened swatch of the carpet. There was a huge charred hole in the wall behind the desk and the ceiling above it, with naked joists and rafters gone to charcoal, and Mallory's wardrobe, replete with all his London finery, burnt to cindered rags and smashed mirror glass. Mallory was beside himself with anger and a deep foreboding shame.
"You locked your door, sir?" Fraser asked.
"I always do, always."
"May I see your key?"
Mallory handed Fraser his keychain. Fraser knelt quietly beside the splintered doorframe. He examined the keyhole closely, then rose to his feet.
"Were there any suspicious characters reported in the hall?" Fraser asked Kelly.
Kelly was offended.
"May I ask who you are to inquire, sir?"
"Inspector Fraser, Bow Street."
"No, Inspector," Kelly said, sucking his teeth. "No suspicious characters, not to my personal knowledge."
"You'll keep this matter confidential, Mr. Kelly? I assume that, like other Royal Society establishments, you take only guests who are accredited savants?"
"That is our firm policy, Inspector."
"But your guests are allowed visitors?"
"Male visitors, sir. Properly escorted ladies. Nothing scandalous, sir."
"A well-dressed hotel cracksman," Fraser concluded, "and arsonist. Not so good an arsonist as he is a cracksman, for he was rather clumsy in the way he heaped those papers below the desk and the wardrobe. He'd a skeleton bar key for this tumbler lock. Had to scrape about a bit, but I doubt it took him 5 full minutes.
"This beggars belief," Mallory said.
Kelly looked near tears.
"A savant guest burned out of his room? I don't know what to say. I've not heard of such a wickedness since the days of Ludd. 'Tis a shame, Dr. Mallory, a foul shame."
Mallory shook his head.
"I should have warned you of this, Mr. Kelly. I have dire enemies."
Kelly swallowed.
"We know, sir. There's much talk of it among the staff, sir."
Fraser was examining the remnants of the desk, poking about in the litter with a warped brass hanger rod from the wardrobe.
"Tallow," he said.
"We carry insurance, Dr. Mallory," Kelly said hopefully. "I don't know if our policy covers exactly this sort of matter, but I do hope we can make good your losses. Please accept my most sincere apologies."
"It scotches me," Mallory said, looking about the wreckage.
"But not so great a hurt as perhaps they hoped. I keep all my most important papers in the palace safety box, and of course I never leave money here."
He paused.
"I assume the palace safe remains unrifled, Mr. Kelly?"
"Yes, sir," Kelly said. "Or rather, let me see to that at once, sir."
He left hastily, bowing.
"Your friend the Derby stiletto man," Fraser said. "He did not dare dog you today, but once we'd left, he crept up here, cracked the door, and lit candles among your heaped-up papers. He was long and safely gone before the alarm was raised."
"He must know a deal about my schedule," Mallory said. "Knows all about me, I dare say. He's plundered my number. He's taken me for a cake."
"In a manner of speaking, sir,"
Fraser tossed the brass pole aside,
"he's a trumped-up amateur. Your skilled arsonist uses liquid paraffin, which consumes itself and all it touches.
I shan't make that dinner with the agnostics tonight, Fraser. I've nothing to wear."
Fraser stood quite still.
"I can see you face misfortune very bravely, like a scholar and a gentleman, Dr. Mallory."
"Thank you,"
Mallory said. There was a silence.
"Fraser, I need a drink."
Fraser nodded slowly.
"For heaven's sake, Fraser, let us go somewhere where we can do some genuine, blackguard, poverty-stricken drinking, with no false gingerbread glitter thrown over everything. Let us away from the fashionable palace, to a house where they don't mind letting in a man with nothing left but the coat on his back."
Mallory kicked about in the rubble of his wardrobe.
"I know what you need, sir," Fraser said soothingly. "A cheery place to let off a bit of steam, where there's drink and dance and lively ladies."
Mallory discovered the blackened brass toggles of his Wyoming military coat. The sight of this stung him deeply.
"You wouldn't be trying to nanny me, would you, Fraser? I suppose Oliphant told you to nanny me. I think that would be a mistake. I'm in a mood for trouble, Fraser."
"I don't mistake you at all, sir. The day has been very unkind. But then you've yet to see Cremorne Gardens. The only thing I want to see is the stiletto man in the sights of a buffalo rifle."
"I understand that sentiment perfectly, sir."
Mallory opened his silver cigar case. At least he still had that possession. And lit his last prime Havana. He puffed it hard until the calm of good tobacco hit his blood.
"On the other hand," he said at last, "I suppose your Cremorne Gardens might well do in a pinch."
Fraser led the way, far down Cromwell Lane, past the great pile of pale brick that was the diseased chest hospital. A nightmarishly dire place this evening, Mallory could not help but think. A vague notion of medical grimness continued to prey on Mallory's mind, so much so that they stopped at the next public house, where Mallory had four or possibly five shots of a surprisingly decent whiskey. The pub was crowded with New Brompton locals, who seemed quite cheery in a cosy, besieged sort of way, though they kept slipping tuppenny bits into a pianola that tinkled "Come to the Bower," a song Mallory loathed. There was no rest for him here. In any case, it was not Cremorne Gardens. They came across the first sign of real trouble a few blocks down New Brompton Road, by Bennett and Harper's patent floor-covering manufactory. An unruly crowd of uniformed men milled at the gates of the sprawling factory. Industrial trouble of some sort. It took Fraser and Mallory some time to discover that the crowd actually consisted almost entirely of policemen. Bennett and Harper's produced a gaily patterned, waterproof stuff made of burlap, ground cork, and coal derivatives, suitable for trimming and gluing down in the kitchens and baths of the middle class. They also produced great volumes of effluent from half a dozen stacks, which clearly the city would temporarily be better off without. The first officials on the scene, or at least they claimed that distinction, had been a group of inspectors from the Royal Patent Office, pressed into emergency industrial duty by a government contingency plan. But Messrs. Bennett and Harper, anxious not to lose the day's production, had challenged the patent men's legal authority to shut down their works. They were soon confronted by two more inspectors from a Royal Society Industrial Committee who claimed precedent. The local constable had been attracted by the uproar, followed by a flying squad of Bow Street Metropolitans arriving in a commandeered steam bus. Most buses had now been seized by government along with the city's cab fleet, in accordance with contingency measures intended to deal with rail strikes. The police had immediately shut down the stacks. Fine work and a credit to the government's good intentions, but the manufacturer's workers were still on the premises, idle and very restive, for no one had mentioned a holiday with pay, though the workers clearly felt they deserved one under the circumstances. It also remained to be seen who was responsible for guarding the property of Messrs. Bennett and Harper, and who would be responsible for giving the official word to start the boilers again. Worst of all, there seemed to be dire problems with the police telegraph service, rooted, presumably, through the Westminster pyramid of the Central Statistics Bureau. There must be trouble there from the stink, Mallory surmised.
"Your special branch, Mr. Fraser," Mallory said. "Why don't you straighten these dullards out?"
"Very witty," Fraser said.
"I wondered why we hadn't seen officers patrolling the streets. They must be snarled up in the premises of factories all over London."
"You seem awfully pleased about the matter," Fraser said.
"Bureaucrats," Mallory scoffed cheerily. "They might have known this would happen, if they'd properly studied catastrophist theory. It is a concatenation of synergistic interactions. The whole system is on the period-doubling route to chaos."
"What does that mean, pray?"
"Essentially," Mallory said, smiling behind his kerchief, "in layman's terms, it means that everything gets twice as bad, twice as fast, until everything falls completely apart."
"That's savantry talk.
You don't presume that has anything to do with real matters here in London, do you?"
"Very interesting question,"
Mallory nodded.
"Deep metaphysical roots. If I model a phenomenon accurately, does that mean I understand it? Or might it be simple coincidence, or an artifact of the technique? Of course, as an ardent simulationist, I myself put much faith in engine modelling. But the doctrine can be questioned, no doubt of it. Deep waters, Fraser. The sort of thing that old human Bishop Berkeley used to thrive on.
You're not drunk, are you, sir?
Just a bit elevated, Mallory said. Squiffy, you might say. They tramped on, wisely leaving the police to their squabbling. Mallory suddenly felt the loss of his good old Wyoming toggle coat. He missed his canteen, his spyglass, the snug stiffness of a rifle over his back, the look of a cold, clean, wild horizon where life was fully lived and death was swift and honest. He wished he were out of London, on expedition again. He could cancel all his engagements. He could apply for funding to the Royal Society, or better yet, the Geographical. He would leave England.
"You needn't do that, sir," Fraser said. "Might make matters worse, actually."
"Was I talking aloud?"
"A bit, yes, sir."
"Where could a man get a first-class game rifle here in town, Fraser?" They were behind Chelsea Park now, in a place called Camera Square, where the shops offered fancy optical goods. Talbot types, magic lanterns, phenakistoscopes, telescopes for the amateur stargazer. There were toy microscopes for the boy savant of the house, boys often taking a strong interest in the wriggling animalcules in pond water. The minute creatures were of no practical interest, but their study might lead young minds to the doctrines of genuine science. Stung by sentiment, Mallory paused before a window displaying such microscopes. They reminded him of kindly old Lord Mantell, who had given him his first job tidying up about the Lewis Museum. From there he'd moved to cataloguing bones and birds' eggs, and at last to a real Cambridge scholarship. The old lord had been a bit eager with a birch switch, he now recalled, but likely no more than Mallory had deserved. There came an odd whizzing sound from up the pavement. Mallory glanced in that direction and saw a queer, half-crouching, ghostly figure emerge from the fog, clothing flapping about it with speed, a pair of walking canes doubled up under its arms. Mallory jumped back at the last possible instant as the boy shot past him with a yowling whoop. A London boy, 13 or so, on rubber-wheeled boots. The boy turned swiftly, skidded to an expert stop, and began to pole himself back up the pavement with the walking sticks. Presently an entire pack of boys had surrounded Mallory and Fraser, leaping and yelping in devilish glee. None of the others had wheeled shoes, but nearly all wore the little square cloth masks that bureau clerks donned to tend their engines.
"Say, you lads," Fraser barked, "where did you get those masks?"
They ignored him.
"That was dead flash," one of them shouted. "Do it again, Bill."
Another boy cocked his leg three times with an odd ritual motion, then jumped high in the air and crowed, "Sugar!" Those around him laughed and cheered.
"Calm down, you," Fraser ordered.
"Vinegar fizz,"
a wicked boy fleered at him.
"Shocking bad hat."
The whole pack of them burst into raucous hilarity.
"Where are your parents?" Fraser demanded. "You shouldn't be running about in this weather."
"Nuts and knuckles," sneered the boy in wheeled shoes. "Forward all, my hearty crew, Panther Bill commands."
He jabbed his walking sticks down and off. The others followed, yelling and whooping.
"Far too well dressed to be street Arabs," Mallory remarked.
The boys had run off a short distance and were setting up for a game of crack the whip. Swiftly each boy grabbed the next by the arm, forming a chain. The boy on wheels took the tail end.
"Don't like the look of that," Mallory muttered.
The chain of boys swung out across Camera Square, each link gathering impetus, and suddenly the wheel-footed boy shot loose from the end like a stone from a catapult. He skidded off with a scream of devilish glee, hit some small discontinuity in the pavement, and tripped headlong into a sheet of plate glass. Shards of glass burst from the storefront, toppling like guillotine blades. Young Panther Bill lay upon the pavement, seemingly stunned or dead. There was an awful moment of shocked silence.
"Treasure!"
shrilled one of the boys. With maddened shrieks, the pack scrambled for the broken storefront and began grabbing every display item in sight, telescopes, tripods, chemical glassware.
"Halt!" Fraser shouted. "Police!"
He reached inside his coat, yanked his kerchief down, and sounded three sharp blasts on a nickel-plate police whistle. The boys fled instantly. A few dropped their snatched booty, but the rest clutched their prizes fiercely and ran like Barbary apes.
Fraser hoofed it after them, Mallory at his heels, reaching the storefront where Panther Bill still lay sprawled. As they approached, the boy levered himself up on his elbow and shook his bleeding head.
"You're hurt, son," Mallory said.
"I'm right and fly," said Panther Bill sluggishly.
His scalp was slashed to the bone and blood was pouring over both his ears.
"Hands off me, you masked bandits!"
Belatedly, Mallory pulled his own kerchief down and tried to smile at the boy.
"You're injured, son. You need help."
Together with Fraser, he bent over the boy.
"Help!" the boy screeched. "Help me, my crew!"
Mallory turned to look. Perhaps one of the other boys could be sent for aid. A glittering, triangular shard of flung glass spun from the fog, catching Fraser square in the back. The policeman jerked upright with a look of wide-eyed animal shock. Panther Bill scrambled off on his hands and knees and jumped to his skidding feet. There was a loud smash from another storefront nearby, the musical clatter of glass and delighted screams. The glass shard protruded in shocking fashion from Fraser's back. It was embedded in him.
"They're going to kill us," Mallory cried, hauling Fraser along by the arm.
Behind them, glass was bursting like bombs, some of it flung blindly to shatter against the walls, some cascading from its shopfront mullions.
"Bloody hell," Fraser muttered.
Panther Bill's cry rang through the fog.
"Treasure, my heart is treasure!"
"Clench your teeth," Mallory said.
Folding his kerchief to protect his hand, he plucked the shard from Fraser's back. To his great relief, it came out of a piece. Fraser shuddered. Mallory helped him gently out of his coat. Gore had streaked Fraser's shirt to the waistline, though it seemed not as bad as it might have been. The glass shard had stabbed the chamois leather strap of Fraser's shoulder holster, which held a stout little pepper box.
"Your holster stopped most of it," Mallory said. "You're cut, but it's not deep, not through the ribs. We need to staunch that bleeding." "Police station," Fraser nodded. "King's Road West."
He'd gone very pale. A fresh cascade of smashing glass echoed distantly behind them. They walked on swiftly, Fraser wincing with each step.
"You'd better stay with me," he said. "Spend the night at the police station. This has become very bad." "Surely," Mallory said. "Don't trouble yourself." "I mean it, Mallory."
"To be sure." 2 hours later, Mallory was in Cremorne Gardens. The document under analysis is a holographic letter. The letterhead has been removed, and the sheet was hastily folded. There is no date, but holographic analysis establishes that it is the genuine script of Edward Mallory, written in haste and in a condition suggesting some loss of muscular coordination. The paper stock, of modest quality and badly yellowed by age, is of a sort in common governmental use in the mid-1850s. Its probable origin is the King's Road West police station. The text, in a badly faded ink from a pen nib worn by long use, reads as follows.
"Madame, I have told no one, but someone must be told. I conclude that you must be my confidant, for there is no one else. When I took your property into my safekeeping, I did so freely. Your request is one I honour as I would a royal command, and your enemies are, of course, my own. It is the highest privilege of my life to act as your paladin. Pray do not be alarmed for my safety. I beg you, take no steps on my behalf that might endanger yourself. Any risk in this battle I assume gladly, but there is indeed risk. Should the worst befall me, it is likely that your property would never be recovered. I have examined the cards. I believe I have some inkling of their use, though they are far beyond my meagre skills in enginery. If this was an impertinence, I beg your pardon. I have bound the cards securely in wrappings of clean linen, and personally sealed them away within an airtight container of plaster. That container is the skull of the Brontosaurus specimen in the Museum of Practical Geology in Jermyn Street. Your property now reposes in perfect safety, some 30 feet above the ground. No human soul knows this, excepting yourself, and your ladyship's most humble servant, Edward Mallory, F.R.S., F.R.G.S.